You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, how revolutionary was Bill Walton? All right, we are back. I am Jason. With me, as usual, is Rich. And we are talking about Bill Walton, of course, one of the great forces in basketball history when healthy. That's always kind of the caveat with Walton.
Well, what are your thoughts on Bill Walton, the commentator, the basketball commentator? Because I've always enjoyed him, but there are a lot of people that don't.
Yeah, he is sometimes very good and very interesting, and then he is sometimes very much. I think the blowhard, you know, fall in love with his voice type stuff is also very apt. But for the most part, he brings enough interesting personality things that I'm pretty cool with what he does.
Okay, so you're pro, and I agree. There are times when he's a little great, but I'm pro Bill Walton as well.
I'm 80% pro Bill Walton, we'll say.
Okay, that's good. I'm down with that. That'll work for me. It kind of sucks now that he's relegated to like Pac-12 like basketball on Saturday nights or whatever now, but that's all right.
Sure.
He's even more of a loon on those too. If you ever listen to those, because now he just doesn't care because like nobody's watching or listening, and he's in California and he loves it. He's just doing UCLA games. It's actually pretty fun.
Yeah, well, I'm glad he's happy. No, I have not really. There's an occasional, whenever something comes on Twitter or I run into something of some goofy thing that he's done. But for the most part, I'm surprisingly not checking out a whole lot of Pac-12 basketball. So
yeah, well, neither am I. Really.
So. Bill Walton, as a player, he was an amazing passer, defender, shot blocker, and a crafty scorer with a whole range of smarts and skills. Just had the ability to see the floor incredibly well. He won 3 College Player of the Year awards at UCLA and 2 national titles, part of the end of that UCLA dynasty. He initially in his career dealt with 2 injury plague seasons in Portland before the 1977 team became a basketball peer starling and won the NBA title. They seemed on the verge of a dynasty when Walton's foot injury in 1978 led to a nasty divorce with the team. And then he missed all but 14 games over the next 4 seasons and really wasn't able to fulfill the kind of greatness that people expected of him until toward the end of his career when he had a great role off the bench with the 1986 Celtics. But he was a passionate competitor on the court, very demanding, and he had a hard time letting go of things, demanding excellent of others, and fit perfectly with Jack Ramsey. So obviously the breaks of the game covers the Blazers so well. We've done a podcast on that, and some of the podcast on discussing that's going to be attached to the end of this episode. But before this, obviously, we're going to get into some of the revolutionary aspects of Walton, both as a player and as a person.
Yeah, the politics are really where you get a lot of the interesting stuff of Walton, because Walton, of course, on the court is always the idea of, oh, man, if he was healthy, or, oh, man, what could have happened or what could have been or whatever. But as a, kind of a political figure, at least a social figure, I mean, he was a big deal in the mid 70s. I mean, he took tons of media criticism for his politics and his lifestyle, particularly before that team won the 1977, finals. He was just really looked at as Sports Illustrated in 1976 is a great quote. Walton was seen as a doped up, whacked out weirdo, commie loving, acid freak hippie with lice in his hair and Patty Hearst's phone number in his date book, which we'll get to in a bit. But that Patty Hearst line is a nice zinger for the mid 70s. So you might not know exactly what that's about, but we'll get to it here in a sec. Walton was, he was famously anti-establishment, and he was a politically active off the court. He was arrested multiple times at anti-war protests. He spoke out against Richard Nixon and the FBI. A New York Times profile basically said quoted him as he saying no one over 35 should be president, and that blacks had been oppressed by white Americans for so long that they had every right to shoot them. So a lot of real interesting stuff. He criticized the national anthem among a multitude of other more or less cherished things and started getting hate mail. And thankfully, our country in 2016 does not, care all that much about what people do during the national anthem. And we've moved on from that. So it's a good thing that now,
thank goodness.
Walton, after Walton got it out of the people's system, they said, it's just a song, it doesn't represent one type of people. This is good. However you're attached to that song, be attached to it. That's fine. It's real good. I'm glad that they, we can do that now. But yes, the connection with Patty Hearst, you're probably wondering what, for people that don't know who Patty Hearst is, it's pretty easy to figure out some kind of background information on her. We're just going to talk about sort of what happened to her and in connection with Walton. But on February 4th, 1974, Patty Hearst, who was the daughter of William Hearst, obviously the media mogul.
Granddaughter, but yeah.
Oh, granddaughter, right. Yeah, because the daughter would have been pretty pretty old at this point. But granddaughter. So February 4th, 1974, a band of ragtag revolutionaries calling them the Simonese Liberation Army burst into her apartment. She was 19 at the time. She was living in Berkeley, California, and dragged her away. 2 months after her abduction, she announced that to a stunned public that she had joined the group and taken the name Tania. Is it Tania? I think it's Tania, right?
I thought it was Tania, but I'm not positive.
Tania, whatever. Either one. That's what she took. So, yeah. Her plight over the next year and a half became a mammoth, rolling, endless media event because she really, in a lot of ways, I mean, she went and robbing banks and was just getting into a bunch of trouble. And people just wondered if she had been brainwashed, if this was actually what she wanted to do. It just a real big stuff. I mean, you can look. There's many different. I think there's a few different books that there was one that I read many, many years ago about it that's super interesting as well. But just, yeah, she's just a crazy, weird time for the Hearst family and for her in particular. But Walton and his later wife, Susie, they were living in Portland when the radical activists and friends Jack and Mickey Scott appeared at their home. Jack Scott, whom Walton once described as the most beautiful human being I have ever met, told them that he had been carting Patty Hearst around the country and that the heat was on from the FBI. So when Walton was questioned by the FBI, he drove from Portland to San Francisco for the meeting with the FBI. News reports noted that he had once been arrested for participating in an anti-war sit-in and had made anti-American statements about being overpaid by the Trailblazers. And Walton, from the beginning, said that he knew nothing about her whereabouts. Just he knew that little quote from Scott. So,
yeah. I just want to mention the accounts. There's a good account of this from Oregon Live, where we took some of the notes from that about why Patty Hearst deal and why Walton was linked to it. So it's a good read for anyone who we'll put it at the end of the show notes.
Absolutely. In spring 1975, Walton appeared at a press conference with Jack Scott. Walton was to describe the FBI, which had also questioned him in the Hearst case, as the enemy and to call for the rejection of the U.S. government. According to Breaks of the Game, Walton's home in the late 70s was considered a center of activity among counterculture figures at the time. Walton later split with Jack Scott around the same time that Walton decided he wanted to leave the Blazers and charge the medical staff and trainers with malpractice. So he kind of got into some more of his like personal stuff that he was kind of trying to get through, and less, you know, worrying about the kind of revolution going on in the 70s and with Jack Scott and all those people as well. But yeah, so that's his not exactly, you know, primarily linked to Patty Hearst, but at least some stuff going on with, you know, people that knew Patty Hearst, yeah, or at least had some connections to her and Bill Walton. So not necessarily a direct connection between the two, but still very interesting how their paths did cross.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly got chance and, you know, ridiculed for his association with the Jack Scott and all that stuff. I mean, that was obviously a big part of what was going on in the culture and how he was thought of at the time. So his lifestyle, he was known for his beard and his long hair. He says he was the first NBA player with a ponytail, loved the Grateful Dead, was staunchly anti-capitalist, outspoken vegetarian, loved the outdoors and riding his bike. He lived in a commune. He smoked marijuana. In fact, he even reportedly sought and received permission from John Wooden to smoke after games during his senior season, wore flannel shirts and multicolored headbands, toted his gym clothes in an onion bag. So with just a guy who was out there in terms of his personal style, just very different from what athletes were expected to look like, even at this point in the mid-70s, where obviously the way people looked had changed awfully differently from the, you know, conservative early 60s into the mid-1970s. As we talked about some of the media criticism, Time magazine described him as an enigmatic, moody man, called him a bitter critic of U.S. society. I don't believe in capitalism, he said when he signed his pro contract. I believe wealth should be spread around. It pointed out that his deal gave him $2.5 million. He also, an SI article from 78, sort of getting into the issues he'd had with the Portland medical staff, said that because he didn't believe in the use of painkilling drugs, he was called a malingerer, also criticized for his radical politics and his counterculture lifestyle. Everything from his clothing to his hairstyle to his diet was harpooned. I've been accused of being a communist, hiding Patty Hearst and taking LSD before a game, he said. He also famously shunned reporters, especially local ones, and only spoke to reporters who would present him favorably. Later, he said a lot of the aloofness or unwillingness to talk was due to a speech impediment, which he would later get successful therapy for. And of course, now the fact that he became, you know, a successful broadcaster for so long, speaks to the dramatic change that he was able to have because of that. And there's a funny anecdote from Breaks to the Game where Walton refused to give the Blazers publicity man his phone number, which created studies of journalism, because all the time he would get phone calls and you would have to admit, I don't have his phone number. The quote from his, the man, John White, was, every radical and subversive in America has his number and I don't.
That's awesome. But getting back to, you know, Walton on the court, you know, he was just a super revolutionary player because, you know, he could just really do it all on the court. And we mentioned that, you know, at the top of the show, of that he just kind of he was a smart player, knew where to be at all times. It was just really good at all different assets, you know, facets of the game. And his stats from 75 to 78 is, you know, arguable healthy prime. 17.1 points per game, 13.5 rebounds per game, 4.4 assists per game, one steal per game, 2.6 blocks per game, 22.1 PER, 20.7 total rebound percentage, 19.3 assists per game percentage, 24.5 usage rate, 26 win shares, 0.178 win shares per 48, 6.0 box plus minus, and a 14.2 value over replacement player. All those are really, I mean, they're pretty stellar numbers across the board. You know, not, you know, maybe not all time great, you know, in that sense, but really just the versatility, it just really jumps out at you. And the one that I really caught was the 4.4 assists per game, which might seem kind of meager, but when you look at it, there are only three centers all time who average 4+ assists per game throughout their career, and it's Wilt, Bill Russell, and Alvin Adams are the only three ever to do that. So you really look at that, and four assists per game, you know, might seem like not that big of a deal, but for centers, that's a big deal. You know, usually when the ball gets to a center or a big man, he, you know, turns around and puts it in the basket. They're very rarely the centers are there to kind of pass around and do all that sort of stuff. So it's interesting to see that, you know, he was on that level at least for a little bit part of his career.
Yeah, and like Russell was running the offense a lot as well. You know, was,
yeah, exactly. I mean, but the ball went to him. Yeah, yeah. That was like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Basketball, in a lot of ways, was a liberation to Walton. He knew how to funnel his ego into the game itself. He was always in the right place and took so much pleasure in just kind of playing the game. The problem, though, is he was obsessed with basketball. He just really couldn't ever let it go. He was, you know, super competitive. He hated playing subpar competition, and he was hard to motivate because of that. You know, practices, I don't think, did a whole lot for him. He just really wanted to play games and then beat people and do that sort of stuff. He considered creating his own semi-pro team, but he wanted the best competition in the NBA, even though he said he hated the business. So he was always kind of conflicted in that. Where, you know, he wanted to be in the elite level of basketball and play against elite level players, but just hated the fact that the NBA had become that big business or whatever. And Walton's high school coach, he thought that his shyness drove his love of passing, which, again, we mentioned again with the 4.4 points per game. And now Jack Ramsey, you know, his famous head coach, had a really nice connection with Bill Walton. They just, as you said at the top of the show, they really just understood one another. And this is Ramsey talking about Bill Walton. There was always a rhythm to his game. It was always the right rhythm. Felt Walton had a great concept of the game and great intelligence. With him, they always knew they could do it as a team. No one understands the game the way he does. And they both had an idealism about the game and just believed in its artistry like it was ballet. And just really were just staunch competitors as well. So those two, I mean, you really do, you do feel for the fact that Walton did get hurt and those two just couldn't have like a 10-year run or, you know, sort of a Popovich Duncan run, because you felt like that could have been that way where they were on the exact same wavelength, but obviously injuries and, you know, struggles with the franchise got in the way of that. But yeah, you really do wish that's one thing that I really would have loved is those two just being linked together for, you know, 15 years or something like that would have been really awesome. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they both had a similar, you know, they both had the similar idealism, but they also had the similar obsession about the game. You know, they, it mm-hmm. very much, you know, of two minds of that, which, you know, was one aspect where, you know, maybe that led to that split apart. You know, and of course, the injuries were the primary thing, but also a little bit of maybe they were almost too much alike, where that kind of created some issues, you know, the little bit of a split there. So how revolutionary was Walton's team? They were they were only rather pedestrian, 49-33, and tied for fourth that season, the 77 season. There are five teams in the league that had between 48 and 50 wins, and we're first in the league in SRS, 5.39, which is, you know, nothing normally special, but considering, if you consider how they were this season and how they were in the 78 season, and I consider how they played with Walton in the lineup in the 77 season, they were 44-21, and they had a 67% winning percentage, which would have been best in the league. So with Walton in the lineup, when they were healthy, they were absolutely a dominant team, and really one of very few dominant teams in that post-merger morass in the NBA. We've talked about how, you know, there just weren't any teams that were really, really great or really bad during there. That was a very much an era of parity. So they were the kind of the one team that sort of was able to stand out during that time when Walton was healthy. But they'd fired Lenny Wilkins the previous year and hired Jack Ramsey. They added Maurice Lucas, Dave Twardzig, Herm Gilliam, and Johnny Davis. And once they started to have a great deal of success, Blazer Mania was the phenomenon that was called, and games became cultural events in the cities. They would show closed circuit versions at a local theater. They would sell out routinely for years afterward. They would sell out routinely, and fans would leave gifts on Walton's porch and would follow him on his biking route to the game. The key players alongside of Walton: Maurice Lucas, the perfect complement to Walton, just a big, strong enforcer, also a good shooter, and really drew the attention and the heat away from Walton, would be booed at away games and would just serve to fill all the things that Walton wasn't good at. Lucas was great at everything, and they meshed together so well. And personality wise, there's a good story in Walton's book, where the first time they meet, Lucas squeezes Walton's hand hard and he says, "We're going to win the NBA championship." And then it'll pause this year. And Walton thought, you know, there's no way, he's crazy. He's just been through these 2 years in Portland and they were kind of a mess. And he just didn't think that, you know, there was any chance of that happening. And of course, they end up doing it. And other key players, Lionel Hollins, of course, now the famous coach. He was a dynamic fast guard. And Bob Gross, who, his numbers were unimpressive, but he was considered one of the best small forwards in the league just with his ability to move without the ball, great court vision and passing and defense. Dave Twardzig, who was kind of a relic of the 50s in terms of his personal style, but was a really great high shooting guard. He shot 61% as a guard for that season, to 10 points per game. So, you know, pretty good production coming off the bench. Larry Steele, who was known for diving for loose balls, survivor in Portland over several regimes. He and Walton didn't really get along all that well. He kind of felt that Walton looked down at his skills. And in terms of, you know, Ramsey was a guy who valued speed and quickness, remade the team around his philosophy and Walton's skills, molded the crew into a rebounding and running package that thrilled the Portland crowds. And also he had his assistant Jack McKinney, who would later become the initial architect of the Lakers Showtime years before. Unfortunately, he had a bicycle accident that caused him to miss a significant amount of time and ended up being replaced by Paul Westhead.
Absolutely. And now we'll get into a little bit of the highlights of the Blazers, you know, their playoff runs throughout this time. The first one we're going to bring up. So 1977, the Bulls, of course, had Artis Gilmore. I still had Norm Van Leer and Tom Boerwinkel from the early 70s. And they added Mickey Johnson and Jack Maron. Just a pretty solid team. They won 44 games that year. But it was after a 2-14 start and a 13 game losing streak that year as well. So they started off real, real bad. And then they went 20-4 to end the season. And they also had their a huge jump in fan support at the time, because the Bulls were basically just a dead franchise before really this season. And this was actually interesting as well, because the Blazers, of course, led by, you know, Bill Walton, and the Bulls led by Artis Gilmore. This was a rematch of 1970, the NCAA title game, which saw Walton's UCLA team beat Artis Gilmore's Jacksonville team, which is a very odd team to be in the NCAA finals. But when you have Artis Gilmore, I guess it's a little bit easier. But yeah, so they beat Jacksonville to win the NCAA title in 1970s. This game, you know, this series is known for, you know, some oddities as well, because there was a referee strike going on during the time. So they used replacement refs. Maurice Lucas was not very happy about that. So he, you know, there was many times where he got frustrated. Players were just frustrated throughout these, but Lucas in particular, he got a second tech in technical foul in game one. He strided towards the ref, grabbed his whistle, and broke the lanyard of the whistle. The ref backed down and then didn't call the technical. So that's I don't know if that sets a great precedent, but anyway, that's replacement refs. And then both Walton and Gilmore described the game two as the wildest of their careers. Right before the half, there was a little skirmish between Wilbur Holland of the Bulls and Herm Gilliam of the Portland Trailblazers. Maurice Lucas jumped in the middle of it all, and quickly this altercation was blowing up into a real bare knuckles fight. Bulls assistant coach Gene Tormo Helen, was trying to pull off Gilliam with his hands around Gilliam's neck, and then Lucas punched him. So as you can tell, Maurice Lucas liked to get in fights, which we talked about during the breaks of the game. He liked to get in them and end them and do all that sort of stuff. But yeah, he decked a assistant coach, which that's not great. So you don't want that.
Yeah. One question quickly. Had you heard of that season as a Bulls fan where they, you know, finished 20-4 to end the season? And because that apparently was a big deal at the time. It kind of rallied the city and it got them really some crazy crowds. And it was right around the time and where the mayor had died. And it was kind of like one of those things that kind of rallied the city around that. So I read What's Happening, where they talk about that, you know, it's mostly about the Sonics, but they kind of get into that a little bit as well, which I thought was interesting because it was something that I hadn't really heard about.
Yeah, no, I thought mostly it was that early 70s Bulls team that really got people going. You know, that 73, 74 team, I remember that, you know, I thought that was always considered the team, you know, with Dick Mata and at the helm, you know, starting. I thought that was always the, you know, the Bob Love era, and that's the one was the one where everybody started to say, hey, we like the Bulls. But yeah, it was kind of interesting to see in different things that we researched that this was a team. I'll have to ask, you know, my dad or something like that to see what if he remembers that in particular, because I had always thought that it was, again, that early 70s team that really reinvigorated them. And then it kind of went through the 70s with the Bulls still being, you know, a decent thing. And then the 80s would, of course, have not so great stuff until you know, a little bit mid-decade. But yeah, I don't know. I hadn't heard that was such a big deal. But
yeah, I think it was short-lived, but it was interesting to see how they ended up finishing that season. And, you know, they obviously starting 2-14 and finishing 20-4 is quite a dichotomy.
So 1977, the Blazers defeated the Nuggets 4-2. This is the Nuggets team. They had David Thompson, Dan Issel, Bobby Jones, because, you know, Issel was great at transition and great at drawing fouls. So Walton had a little tough matchup with Dan Issel. He was a fantastic player, and we've talked about many times during this series as well, a guy who really just kind of gets underlooked or underrated as being an all-time great. Game one, Maurice Lucas broke a play to back his man down, shot over him, and score from the low post for the game winner at Denver. Ramsey later complained to Luke about it. Come on, Jack, we won the game. So that was interesting. There was, you know, Ramsey, again, he was a guy who kind of wanted stuff his way. And, you know, he wanted to win. He wanted to be a competitor, but he wanted guys to, you know, listen and kind of do a lot of what he wanted to. So it's an interesting thing there. Twarzak was hurt in the series. Johnny Davis, who was at that time a 20-year-old quiet rookie, was put in at Walton's suggestion over Ramsey's preference as Larry Steele. And that's the worst idea I think I ever
heard. That was what Walton said, right? When Ramsey wanted Larry Steele, Walton said that's the worst idea I think ever
heard. Yeah, right, so. Which speaks to your point that you meant earlier, that Larry Steele didn't really like Bill Walton that much because he felt that, you know, Bill Walton didn't respect his skills as well. But it was definitely a close series as well. Portland won game one by 1 point and game three by 4 points. But still, you know, got through it. And then Blazers 4, Lakers 0. This is, of course, 1977, rather. Walton versus Kareem. The Lakers, though, are incredibly shorthanded with Kermit Washington out and Lucius Allen was hobbled. Hollins and Davis harassed the overmatched Lakers guards for lots of steals and fast break opportunities throughout. Herm Gilliam, he came off the bench to spark the Blazers to a close win in Los Angeles for game 2. And then Walton punctuates the win in game 4 with a dunk over Kareem. Heading in, there was talk about the second coming of Russell versus Wilt, but the series kind of disappoints. We'll have a lot more about this rivalry and whatnot in future shows, because we're going to talk a little bit about these two in a little bit more detail later. But yeah, it was just an interesting, you know, the first, you know, you get Walton versus Kareem, kind of think it's a big deal. But yeah, the Blazers kind of destroy the Lakers, you know, 4-0. So you kind of lose that a little bit. So
yeah. So looking at the finals, which the Blazers famously won 4-2 over the 76ers, Dr. J, and lots of characters on the Sixers team, as we've talked about in other shows. The Sixers actually won big in the first two games, and then in game 2, a big brawl. It starts with Lloyd Neal and George McGinnis squaring off, and then Lucas and Irving trade elbows. Finally, it's really prompted by Gross and Daryl Dawkins having a tug of war over rebound, and they start punching. And Dawkins actually ends up knocking Doug Collins instead of Gross. Then Lucas goes after Dawkins with a shot from behind, and then both benches clear and everyone's involved. It's this big mess, of course, in a finals game. The fact that this happened is pretty crazy. And Collins needed 4 stitches. Lucas and Dawkins were rejected, and they were each fined $2,500 each, which was one of the first major financial fines for fighting. It was right around the time which they started cracking down on it seriously. Then Portland turned around and won big game 3 and 4 in Portland. Lucas, before game 3, he walked right to the Philly bench and then startled everybody, including Dawkins, by sticking out his hand for a handshake. And then that kind of threw off the Sixers and tried to, you know, kind of got in their head a little bit, because it was just sort of like an odd, like, what is he doing kind of thing. So they changed their strategy against Dr. J. They were trying to force him left, which is where he usually would go, but that kept Walton at an angle that was too far away to help. So they switched to letting him drive right, and that gave Walton an ability to get at a better angle and defend better. Also, Bobby Gross, they had him just run and run and run to try to tire Irving out. And Walton said that he felt Gross outplayed Dr. J in the series, moving without the ball and setting a record for a field goal percentage, although Irving had quite an outstanding series production wise so you, that might give you some pause there, but I'm not gonna argue with Bill Walton. George McGinnis, he was 16 of 48 in the first four games. He said, I feel like a blind man searching for the men's room. So game five was more of a physical slog early. The Sixers tried to impose their will, but eventually the Blazers got their running game going, and they were up 91-69 with a little more than 8 minutes left in the game. Then the Sixers had a huge rally. They got to they made it close at the end, but they ended up losing 110-104. And Irving scored 37 points and felt distraught afterward. He said, I had a good feeling about tonight. It all backfired. It's a bad scene. So things went bad in Philly. And then back in Portland for game six, just a crazy atmosphere. The Blazers have 5,000 fans waiting to greet them at 4:30 in the morning when they get home. And Portland had another pretty big lead in the fourth quarter, 6 minutes left. The Sixers made another run, were able to trim it to three after Irving made he made a long jump shot and then later two foul shots. Lucas then got a free throw to get to four. McGinnis actually hit a jumper finally, and 2 points with 18 seconds left. McGinnis actually forced a jump ball from Gross, and Irving got a jumper in the lane, but it was no good. Free got the ball and lofted a baseline shot, again no good. And then McGinnis got a shot off with a second left, and that was it. They were unable to get it going. Walton in the game had 20 points, 23 rebounds, 8 block shots, 5 assists. He knocked the loose ball at the end just to be sure, then ripped off his drenched jersey and hurled it into the crowd. Meanwhile, Irving had 40 points, 8 assists, 6 rebounds, and 2 steals. So great line for him, even in a loss. And apparently 96% of Portland TVs were on during the game six. That's obviously
pretty impressive. That's insane. Yeah. I mean, when people talk about that team being like so, linked to that city as well, I mean, that fact right there, all you have to look at. I mean, Breaks of the Game talks about it as well. It was just a crazed Portland for their Trailblazers. And that's just that fact alone is just absolutely insane.
And that, continued through the 78 season where the Blazers had a 15-10 start and looked like they were on their way to another great team, another great championship run before Walton's injury changed the course of things, which will, after the break, we'll our previously recorded episode we'll get into. You can check it out. You're listening to a conversation with Rich and I, along with Curtis Harris of Pro Hoops History and James of NBA Injury Report.
Hi, this is Jason. Before we get to our discussion of Breaks of the Game, I'd like to tell you about our fellow Harvard Paroxysm Network podcast. Fast Break Breakfast is a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. If you watch League Pass every night but aren't listening, you are missing out. Fast Break Breakfast is what happens when you get two musicians and a comic who are overeducated, underemployed, but share an obsession about the NBA, 90s movies, and conspiracy theories. So make sure you subscribe to Fast Break Breakfast, a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. Also, you can find all of the HP Network podcasts, including Over and Back, in one feed on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, by searching for Hardwood Paroxysm. And now, enjoy the rest of the show.
So, kind of getting into some of the key personalities of the book. I think the central figure is Bill Walton, who was, of course, the centerpiece of that Trailblazers team. Just, an incredible center with superbly skilled, but dealt with injuries throughout most of his career that really prevented him from, reaching even, a percentage of really what he could, other than a couple of great seasons and then kind of a late rebirth with the Celtics as a role player. Didn't have what he could, but just the incredible court vision, the passing, the shot blocking, playmaking was just a for a brief time was arguably maybe the best center in the NBA. I think the way that it kind of portrays him relating to his teammates and the way that it kind of portrays the
locker room dynamics of Jack Ramsey being, you know, pretty stern, you know, kind of being a taskmaster, yet in subtle ways, you know, ceding things to Walton, and how that kind of drove a wedge between Walton and the team, and then sort of led to, you know, once Walton felt betrayed by the medical staff and feeling questioned by teammates, leading to him, you know, driving a wedge between those guys. So, Kurt, I'll start with you. What did you kind of think about the way that Walton was portrayed here?
I find Walton's story pretty interesting, just because, like you said, this is this guy that's, you know, very liberal, the hippie, long hair, still goes to Grateful Dead concerts. But, you know, it's this free-spirited guy, but he's clearly got all this talent, and he's the best player on the team. So it's like this, you get this kind of expectation and swagger when you're the best player on the team, like things are going to be run your way. Which that kind of runs counter to being a hippie and, you know, the free spirited type, because you want everybody to fall in line and what you're doing. So I think that might be the starting point for his like friction with the teammates. Cause after he got the injury, the teammates were ready to like pounce and say like, well, you know, is he faking it, or is it not that bad, or should he be out there playing? Why isn't he like toughing it out or anything like that? So I think that left this idea of him, what he wanted to see himself as, ran counter to the talent that he had. And his teammates, you know, were just, as I said, just quick to pick up on this fact that he wasn't, it's just this complex thing. I'm having a hard time expressing it, but yeah, like it's just the amount of talent that he had and his leftist ideas. Just, I feel like there's just like intrinsic conflict between those two things. Like if you're that talented, you can't be like egalitarian on a basketball court to purest degree and have everybody fall in line and love you, especially when your foot gets hurt, you can't play anymore. And the thing just falls apart as it did in the book.
Yeah. Walton's story for me was just like, it was just super dark. Like he had to wind up, I mean, obviously the career cut short is the obvious thing, but then he had to like basically go against everything that he purportedly stood for at some point. Like there's the whole part about how he didn't want to take shots. He thought it was, you know, betraying like the, you know, the signals that his body was telling him, you know, which is true. You're in pain. Your body's telling you to stop. So he didn't want to do that. Winds up doing that. The whole he becomes a born again capitalist thing was like super dark. Like he like how much was he like searching for, you know, some meaning in life that maybe had been stripped from him when, you know, because he'd already been suffering with his foot injuries for a while. And they have this whole section about how he goes to San Diego and starts wearing suits and talking about being a capitalist. And on a very minor level, having to ditch his beloved vegetarianism to gain some weight, to put on muscle, was, I thought, a little sad as well. So it really, like, ran the gamut of, like, things he had to give up in order to, like, pursue this one dream of his, which I guess was partially why Jack Ramsey loved him so much, because that, I mean, this is, I don't know, there was a lot of dark themes in this, like, but I thought one of the starkest ones was just like the emotional toll of, you know, what it takes to be great. And Jack Ramsey talking about how he wants people who are single-mindedly, you know, focused on basketball. And from a caring about these people's like soul perspective, maybe not the, you know, best approach to take. But if you want the most successful team, like maybe it is. And what does that say about just like what it means to be successful in any endeavor, but, you know, specifically sports in this case. So yeah, I thought there was sadness. There was a deep sadness imbued throughout the entire book, I thought. Bittersweet.
Yeah, yeah. Walt was an interesting character for me because there were points, and I don't know if you guys sort of got this vibe, and I'm sure we're you know, throughout the book, there's times where you sort of really feel bad for him, and other times where you don't, and then it's very weird. Whereas a lot of the guys, I sort of pretty early in their chapter, whatever, their section rather, sort of decide, hey, I really like this guy, or hey, you know, this isn't really my type of guy, or whatever, you know what I mean? Whereas Bill Walton is a guy who throughout, like, I'll read one page and be like, oh, you know, he sounds like a really cool dude, and then, like, the next page, you know, something will happen, like the boarding and capitalism thing, or you sort of see that he's being, you know, hypocritical as far as how this goes, and he's very weird for me. I never could quite find a you know, when it was over, I couldn't really reconcile myself with, okay, do I really think Bill Walton's a good guy or a bad guy? Like, I still don't even know if I know that. And, like, I think deep down he's a good guy, but he did weird stuff throughout. He was a weird character. I think most others in this book, I was able to very easily say, okay, I really enjoy this guy, I like this guy. And most I did like. I mean, there's very few people in this book that I think I, like, kind of give an eye roll to or anything like that. But he was one that I don't quite know. And I'm not sure if you know, David, that was his
his goal is to make him sort of a conflicted character or what, but I at least got that vibe. I don't know if anybody else sort of picked up on that either.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely kind of see like the conflict. Like I thought it was interesting how, you know, there was sort of the stuff where he tries to be of the team and be part of the team and be friendly, but he's also like ribbing guys who are like clearly like way inferior players and just kind of like almost picking on them just because he could, just kind of being a bully, which I thought was ironic because at the end of the book, there's a story about they're at a Clippers game and they're having like a, you know, like a fan costume contest. It's around Halloween, I guess. And then there's a fan who dresses up like, you know, like as Walton, but like in a cast and having some sort of like some sort of sign making fun of him. And then like he ends up winning that contest. And, you know, the crowd's like laughing and Walton is at the game in a suit and just really embarrassed. But I thought like that was just a little bit of karma for the way that like Walton had treated other guys during the game. And you know, I think, you know, Walton's definitely a complex guy. I mean, you know, most of us are, you know, somewhat good and somewhat bad. So it makes sense that he'd be there. I think the two things that I thought were kind of stood out as being interesting for me is when it talked about like his, you know, game day preparation where like hours in, like, he would listen to the dead and he would like actually like picture like actions in the game in his head and, you know, and what he would do in certain things, like when he would make the pass or when he would cut to the basket or whatever. And that reminds me a lot of, I also, for people who don't know, I also do a podcast about Alfred Hitchcock films called the Alfred Hitchcast. And it reminds me of Hitchcock's approach of like basically scripting out every single action, you know, in his head and putting it on the page to where, you know, the actual filming of the movie, he already knew everything that was going to be happening ahead of time because he had, you know, basically all drawn out. It kind of reminded me of that and just kind of shows like the level of basketball genius that Walton was to be able to, you know, just kind of see things that way. And then another thing that was, I thought was kind of funny was, which shows sort of the competitive edge for him and just the hippie stuff is days after winning the championship in 77, he ends up playing a pickup game on an Indian reservation against a team led by Phil Jackson. It's just this casual thing, but he's like playing it like it's, you know, game 7 of the championship. I mean, he's out there and he still like has that huge competitive drive even in that environment. And, you know, hanging out with Phil Jackson in 1977 seems like a, you know, interesting situation. So,
man, but yeah, Rich, you were talking about, you know, how you didn't know what to think about Walton. And I think I'm like, well, maybe he's just the most well-drawn character in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe him or Ramsey, maybe. Because, like, most people, like, if you really know everyone's, you know, deepest thoughts and what they've done right and wrong throughout their life, like, you are going to be conflicted. Like, it's hard to say someone is, like,
sure,
good or bad unless they're, you know, the obvious markers in history of, like, dictators and stuff like that, so.
Obviously, we weren't there, but it's hard to kind of see where at the point, like, Walton is culpable for, I mean, obviously he's, you know, he's responsible for his own actions and he apparently approved all the, you know, the painkillers and the medical treatment that they were giving him. But at the same time, I mean, I think this book does a nice job of pointing out the pressures that he felt in that situation and like the way that maybe, you know, just the conflict that a team doctor or team trainers would have being more loyal to the team than loyal to than loyal to the player.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge issue. Like, as you're just mentioning that, I was thinking like just the phrase, you know, conflict of interest. It's like you're the team's medical doctor and you're, as just a pure doctor or a medical, you know, professional, you're supposed to do what's best for the patient. But if you're getting paid by the team, you know, your other job is make sure that those players are ready to go out there and perform for the team. So if you don't do that in the team's mindset, you're not going to be the doctor for too much longer. So, yeah, that's obviously still a problem in the NBA, but really a huge problem in the NFL, as we all know. But, yeah, Walton definitely is the case of that. You know, it's really hard to say whether he or when he should have had his foot surgery at the, and should have got that taken care of. But, you know, the doctor, he had the conflict of interest, too. He had to keep his job and get Walton healthy to play for the team. Otherwise, he was going to be out of there or as close to healthy as possible, I guess we can say, or else he was going to be out of there.
Sure. And it's possible to, you know, to care about both the players and the team. And it's obviously just, I mean, it just creates the situation. Even if you're doing it well, you're just facing that, those tensions. And yeah, conflict of interest is exactly right. You know, the other, I guess the biggest star of that, you know, those late 70s Blazers teams was Maurice Lucas, who came from the ABA to immediately lead that Blazers championship team along with Walton. I thought it was interesting how it talked about the two of them sort of managing to divide their turf before the title season. You know, Lucas kind of serving as the enforcer for Walton and sort of filling in some of the gaps of, you know, toughness and rebounding and you know, the things that Walton wasn't necessarily as good at, Lucas, you know, was there to absolutely, you know, be basically the perfect complement to him. And Halberstam describes him as, and I'll quote, very black, very articulate, very political, a strong and independent man sprung from circumstances that could also create great insecurity. And that's sort of what he's going through during this season. I mean, he is been underpaid relative to his talent for several seasons, you know, signed a deal coming out of the ABA that, you know, what was not a smart long-term deal. In fact, the Blazers were, you know, sort of, you know, almost forerunners for kind of the strategy of signing players to long-term contracts, but for relatively low money. And then only the first couple years of that being guaranteed. So basically they were, you know, completely in favor of, you know, team contracts. So, you know, he's unhappy with his salary and he's totally willing to push the boundaries of the team, particularly with Ramsey and with management. And, you know, it kind of creates a difficult situation for the team to be under, and certainly one difficult one for him to be under as well. And he's constantly under trade rumors as well. So that's kind of, you know, the tension that's going on during the season.
What do you guys make of, you know, Weinberg in general? I mean, I'm thinking about it as it relates to, you know, Lucas and like his contract, because they make a big deal out of he refuses to renegotiate, and he says, well, I've never done that in my other business. Do you think Halberstam, do you think he's taken him at his word, or does he think that he just knows he can get away with it? So, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he claims this is principled stance, but isn't it kind of easier in some ways to just see, like, well, if he thinks he can get away with not paying them more money, that's what he's going to do because he's a businessman.
Yeah, I took it as purely just a business, like, you know, we just don't want to set the precedent, or we don't want to, you know, it doesn't matter that it's not fair. That's the contract you agreed to, and that's the one that we're going to do. You know, I didn't really see it as much more than that. I saw it as something he could get away with as an owner, and wasn't necessarily, like, compromising his moral code or anything like that. So I thought that that's kind of where I stood on it.
Okay. It just seemed to me like he was trying to make it almost like a moral stand. Like, this is just how I conduct business, where, like, I don't think he really believed that. I don't know. I'm very distrustful of anyone who can rise to that level of power and, like, the motives behind anything that they say. So, you know, if it's going to benefit his pocket, then he's going to say that, where, you know, I don't know. Like, that's an easy thing. I just couldn't tell if the author of our tale believed him or not.
Yeah, and that becomes a problem, I think, in general. It's one of my biggest issues with the book, is I sort of feel like he's always almost more on the side of, and that's, to be fair, I think that's not really a, you know, hot take, that he's more on the side of the management and more on the side of the coaches and that sort of stuff, and less on the players. So yeah, as far as the story of Lucas and those contract negotiations, whatever, I always kind of take it for, because it's hard to know who's giving him the most access, because, and that's the thing, that if you're, you know, it, for people who do any sort of journalism, you always tend to sort of be, you know, pulled in both directions, you know, potentially, if you're looking on a story like that, and maybe, you know, who's ever giving you a little bit more, you know, or making it easier, your job easier or whatever, might get a little more beneficial. But I always felt throughout the book, and especially, I think, this Lucas situation, I felt like he always sort of seemed to sort of paint Lucas and Weinberg in their sort, or Lucas, you know, in his little camp and his way, and then sort of Weinberg and the other guys in there. I don't know. I'm sort of, I didn't, when it was over, I still quite wasn't sure where I stood in terms of that you know, negotiations and who was in the right, who was in the wrong, or if both were right, both were right. You know what I mean? There's a lot more to it, obviously. But yeah, I always sort of felt like, you know, Havisham was sort of more pro management, pro coaches, less, you know, not anti player, but more of the pro coaches, more pro management. But that's at least, and I think you get that throughout the book.
I feel like Lucas was in the 1977 finals. I think his role wasn't quite. I don't think it was explained in a completely like thoughtful manner, and not just by Halberstam, but by general popular consensus or whatever. Because this was a guy, like you mentioned at the very beginning, that he was, you know, he came out of the ABA, and you know, the Blazers were talked about as like the pure basketball squad, the team that played team ball against like the playground Sixers. And it's like, wait a minute, the Blazers had this enforcer, Maurice Lucas, who came out of the ABA. And the reason why that series turned around is because Maurice Lucas like started fighting Daryl Dawkins and intimidated all the Sixers. So like, this doesn't quite jive with the narrative of them as like the perfect team basketball when Maurice Lucas like intimidated the other team into submission. So I feel like that idea wasn't quite expounded upon fully in this book as well as it could have been. Kind of that the paradox in the narrative and the actuality, what took place. But I guess that's a good way to talk about Maurice Lucas, though, because he was very much a, you know, a team player, but also marked off his turf. And like, you know, if he wasn't getting paid his money, he wasn't going to sacrifice for the team. He wanted to get his money. Like the money, his interest came first, and then he would take care of the team. But if he wasn't getting taken care of himself, he wasn't going to stick his neck out for the team in the long run.
And good for him, because they were going to do it for him. Like, I thought the end of the book was great, because he goes to Jersey. He starts playing again. He's like, oh, I'm healthy. And Calvin Natt's a bust. And I felt like the Blazers deserved it. They completely screwed him. He was worth so much more money than they were giving him, and everyone knew it. So, I don't know. I kind of like the way that resolved, to be honest.
One of the other key characters is, of course, Dr. Jack Ramsey, the considered at the time either the best coach in the game or right in that category. Had the loud 70s clothes with the big collars and the gaudy suits. You know, was I definitely think there's very much like the Tom Thibodeau like attitude toward each game of like, you know, absolutely having to do everything you can to win each game. And even maybe sometimes at the expense of the larger picture, you know, just he has the red face, the veins popping, takes losses so hard that he has to work out after midnight or walking alone through the empty streets in strange cities. Also was a big physical fitness guy. And, you know, the other thing is that he had a system that he deeply believed in and liked to contrast it with, you know, systems like guys who didn't fit, guys who were, you know, considered like more one-on-one players or guys who liked to freelance and weren't necessarily fits. Like he turned his nose on those guys. He was, you know, like even someone like Artis Gilmore apparently was someone they were thinking about trading for. And, you know, Gilmore's one of the top two or three big men in the league at the time. And he's like, no, he doesn't pass. So we're not going to do that. You know, that kind of thing. I do think that kind of came to bite him and the Blazers a little bit, you know, with maybe the lacking flexibility, and maybe that limited their options on, you know, who they were able to, even if, you know, if the Lucas situation was untenable, you know, it limited your options of who you could bring in, because, you know, you really needed Bill Walton for the system to work the way that, you know, it did. I mean, other guys could fit in, but it just, you know, it's, I think that was obviously one kind of negative. So Curtis, how did Jack Ramsey come across for you?
Ramsey, I think he did a pretty good job explaining him. He was a hard ass, and mostly a loving way. But he was a hard ass. And you look at his coaching record with the Blazers, which I handily have pulled up in front of me, so I don't get nothing wrong. The team, the worst they ever did was 38-44. And that was the year that Halberstam wrote about, the 79-80 season. So this was a guy that, like, drove his teams and pushed him hard, like, to the max to get to, like, a 42-40 record or a 44-38 record, when they might have been better off just saying, like, well, you know, we got a little, you know, some injuries this year. Guys aren't going to be coming back. Let's just you know, not tank, because they didn't use that word back then, but how about we just let guys rest up and we'll just get ourselves a nice draft pick and kind of try to reload. Jack Ramsey's attitude would not allow for such things. He pushed the team to the maximum of their talent. That's how they got to the finals and won the championship. But part of me thinks like his drive to push the team that hard, like a Thibodeau would, you know, in the long run, like that was not beneficial for the team. Because we forget Walton, well, not like all of us here, but like, you know, generally speaking, people kind of forget that Walton, like his major injury took place in the playoffs in 78. Yeah, 78 when they were playing the Sonics. Like, he came back from his previous foot injury that same year, and like, you know, he rushed back to get there to play in the playoffs, and what happens, he breaks his foot again, and that's what shut him down for like 2 years after that. So you got to think with a coach that was a little less tunnel visioned, I guess is a good term, a little less tunnel vision than Jack Ramsey, he might have said like, what's the point of having him come back for the playoffs? Let's just let him rest and come back next year, hopefully he'll be healthy. Now we can make like a better 3-4 year run instead of trying to make this one run this season.
Yeah, I mean, well, one thing that stands out about those the 77 Blazers is, I mean, Lucas was 24, Walton was 24, Bob Gross was 23, Lionel Hollins was 23, Twardzik was 26, Johnny Davis was 21. Yeah. I mean, you know, basically almost everyone in their core. These were all guys. You know, these were all young guys. I mean, they really could have kept it together and, you know, and been, you know, a great team for, you know, 5, 7, 10 years maybe.
No, I think it's the youngest championship team in NBA history still. Yeah, that was really, really young team. So I don't know why they felt the need to just keep rushing guys back.
Right, and I think, you know, Jason, you mentioned the contrast to Tom Thibodeau, and, you know, obviously me living in Chicago, and James can attest to this as well, doing, you know, running the NBA injury report on Twitter or whatever, is that, yeah, I thought that, and when you mentioned that, I wasn't quite sure, because reading throughout this, and I was saying, Jack Ramsey reminds me of somebody, but who? I couldn't remember, and it was so close to me the entire time, because then when I went to the notes and you said Tom Thibodeau, and I went, yeah, of course, like, duh, that's exactly who, of a guy that just... Every game is like the last game. Like, every game is game 7 of the NBA Finals. We have to win this game. We have to do this. And you get this sort of vibe from him, and you got that from Tom Thibodeau, and you get it from a lot of coaches, you know, in the NBA as well. So I don't want to just say Tom Thibodeau, but the contrast of those two, I thought was, or the contrast in comparing of those two, I thought was really, really important. And I think it absolutely is something that you see with these guys where, yeah, you look at potential teams that could have, you know, had longer runs or whatever, and then you look at a guy who's so focused on winning that next game and winning this game or this season and everything that he can't look at the big picture, can't look at that sort of stuff. And yeah, I think there are definitely, you know, comparisons of that. I mean, I think Jack Ramsey is a far better coach than Tom Thibodeau is, and well, that remains to be seen for a little bit, but I think right now we can, you know, easily say that. But in terms of that, I think it's absolutely, you know, a great comparison of a guy who just was obsessed with winning and just, in a lot of ways, even though he's a very smart man, very intelligent, was so hyper-focused on winning that next game that a lot of times you do sort of lose a lot of the big picture stuff. And you also get the idea as well, and for people, you know, in Chicago, we hear a lot about this, of Tom Thibodeau's just like, he wants everybody to follow his work ethic. Like, he's a guy that's just going to sleep at the gym, you know, he's going to be there in the morning, and like, guys would have to go to other arenas to practice because they didn't want to be around him. Like, they just wanted like one day without him there. And you see that with Ramsey as well, where he can't understand why, you know, his players aren't as committed as he is. And it's like, he just can't wrap his head around that. And he blames it on, oh, these modern players or whatever. It really would be any sort of like, you know, level and era of players would at some point just be like, all right, like, just chill, like, just calm down. It's all right. Like, but Ramsey doesn't see it that way. You know, he's got every game is the most important game ever. And you know, it led them to winning. As you mentioned, it led them to a championship, but it also probably led to that franchise and that dynasty, or the mini dynasty, not having, you know, as much success as they probably could have had.
He made me think of two other people from the game today who have long histories in the NBA that we haven't mentioned yet. And to me, he was almost a combination of, it was a little Scott Skilesy. Like, maybe he's great at like whipping these guys into shape, but after a couple of years, like, might lose them a little bit. And then also, it was shades of Phil Jackson with just the adherence to a system, perhaps sometimes to the detriment of, you know, talents that might not thrive in that particular system, but could be of use if you were, you know, just a little bit more flexible. But in general, I just thought he was, a man of contradictions. Like, you've got, I thought it was interesting that, you know, he's this really old school presence, but he has these like wild modern clothes. Like, I don't know, that like speaks to something in his like psychology that I find sort of strange. Cause usually when someone is that like work ethic-y, I mean, it's like a very broad stroke thing to say, but you don't think of them as being like flamboyant in their dress, like usually. Yeah. And then you've got like the, he kind of has this preternatural ability to kind of see what's happening before it happens. Yet you've got this image of this, like the sweatiest coach in all of basketball who like literally sweats through whatever. Like, how could you sweat through dress shoes? I'm assuming he was wearing, right? Like, I've never heard of that before. Like, sneakers is one thing, but like visible sweat through your dress shoes, like that's a tremendous amount of sweat. So I just thought, I'm not exactly sure what to make of him, because he did have a lot of contradictions, but I guess that's also like pretty normal and human. But I thought, yeah, that was good, a good part on Halberstam to kind of show that he's not just like this robot, perfectionist. Yeah.
I thought that was good too. And I thought that sort of the rivalry in contrast with Lenny Wilkins was interesting, because Wilkins had preceded him in Portland, and then Ramsey came in during the championship year, and people obviously gave Ramsey a lot of credit for doing that. But Wilkins is, you know, privately kind of saying, well, you know, yeah, but I never had a healthy Bill Walton either, you know. So there are obviously a lot of factors that led to that. But then Wilkins went to Seattle and then won a championship in 79. And he's sort of more known as a player's coach, a little bit more easygoing, but he's also in the same year, in fact, he's coping with some of the same problems of success that Ramsey's had to deal with in Portland, particularly feuding with Dennis Johnson. And Wilkins is kind of, Ramsey is sort of put off. I forget if they specifically mentioned it with Wilkins, but he's sort of put off with the former players being named coaches. Like, he feels like, you know, I'm a coach and this is a serious profession. And it goes through his, you know, extensive college a career at St. Joe's and having a long time, you know, long-standing coaching and taking it very seriously. Not that Lane Wilkins didn't take coaching seriously, but it's just like the idea that like a player could just kind of walk in and do it is sort of offends his sensibilities. And so they have kind of a, you know, they don't ever like, you know, talk shit about each other, but they definitely have like a, I like sort of drawing the parallels between the two coaches, even though they're in a very similar situation during the season.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say, it just really sucks what happened with Lenny Wilkins up in Seattle. Like the feud with Dennis Johnson, that's one of the things that pisses me off the most. Thinking back on the NBA in that period, because that just, you ever talk about the Blazers being like potential dynasty, the Sonics were also a potential, not I quite say dynasty, but they're going to be contenders for like 5 years in a row. But like Dennis Johnson, just, I don't know what the hell happened to him, but he just started to hate everybody on the team and everybody started to hate him. And then Gus Williams, the very next year, held out for a new contract. So what was happening with the Blazers was not unique. There was definitely like players, I guess, feeling more assertive about their contract status, wanting to get their money that they felt they deserved, and that management wasn't paying up. So I feel like a almost equally interesting book could have been written about the Sonics from the same season.